that underlies it.
Mr. Chair, if I may add, I think what would help too, Representative Bates, is that mock tax form that the Department of Revenue gave you on Friday. That's something that people in the tax department could look at and would be able to understand pretty quickly what you're talking about in terms of the bay.
Okay.
And we have more copies of that, too.
That's this one right here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The 2,000 question mark.
Yeah. That's good.
Hey, anything else? All right, let's invite former revenue chairs, John Schoon and Tom Bryan, forward to join us in the Batcave. I bet you really wish you were up here, both of you, huh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It is nice being on this side. We were invited today to lend what we could to your deliberations and give you the opportunity to draw on any experience we may have had, and so please feel free to do that. Myself, I don't have any prepared testimony in the sense that I'm here to support the bill specifically, but I can say that this type of tax does reduce the volatility that you are experiencing right now and may experience even more. I was here in 1981 when we had a very severe recession, came into special session three times because of the drop in revenues that occurred primarily from the reduction in the business income tax, but also then personal income taxes also. So the potential for revenues to drop throughout the state is even greater now because we had a much greater reliance on the property tax system, which is a very stable system, of course. Now, with the heavy reliance on income tax, the potential for greater volatility exists even more now. Measure 5, of course, caused property taxes to be reduced on a statewide basis. It also has changed, or been part of the change at least, in the amount of taxes paid relative to individuals and business. And you may want to look at that and see something like this as a way of perhaps drawing it back to something closer than it was in the past. One thing I do like about this type of proposal is that no new bureaucracy is required in order to administer it. With the sales taxes that we worked on, one thing that I always disliked is that it would have taken an entirely new staff of people to collect the tax and administer it because it wouldn't mesh with anything that we're doing now. This would mesh very well with the income tax system that we have at this time.
Thank you, John. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for inviting our testimony today. I'd like to just start with just a few overview comments. First of all, I sincerely want to congratulate the chair and the committee for raising the issue of tax reform or reviewing our tax structure in Oregon. As John had mentioned, I guess, you know, every time you bring up changing the tax system, there are detractors that appear out of the blue. A lot of people, on the other hand, would offer criticism of our current tax structure and its weaknesses. So either way you go, you're going to have critics. But I think the thing that I would like to urge and what you're pursuing here is to look at something. I think most people who are informed in our tax system would agree that we're in a pretty precarious situation when you look long term. If you look at a 5-year, 10-year look, we're in a pretty precarious situation, and something does need to be done to stabilize our revenue sources. And complacency, I think, is almost our biggest enemy. Every time someone's talked about key tax reform issues over the last 8-9 years, of my knowledge, people were, you know, pretty happy. I mean, everything's going along pretty well. And I suggest that that won't be the case if, in fact, we get anywhere near an early 80s type of recession. As you know, every tax has its strengths and weaknesses, its different effects on different people, elements of progressivity and regressivity, and then there's issues of stability and predictability. And it's because of this, I think most economists would always tell us we should have more than one source. We should have two or three major sources for our state government revenues. Traditionally, as you know, the state of Oregon has been a two-tax system, property tax, which took care of local government and schools, and state income tax, which took care of state government principally. That's all changed through Measure 5 in terms of the K through 12 has now shifted 70% to the state. Measure 50 further capped and cut and capped the property taxes. And with the growth in population and personal income has taken even a larger proportion of our overall income revenues. So I think we're almost down to a one-legged stool, upon which state government sits, along with our schools, and as I mentioned, precariously balanced. The way I've used, you've probably heard some of these, but part of this, I think, is for the public record as well. I like to use 1997 data because it's the one, that's the data I know best, because I was chair then, and because the numbers happen to work out in real nice round numbers to illustrate my point. And I think they are proportional today, and you would know the new numbers. But in 1997, the general fund was about $10 billion. Personal income tax was $9 billion of that, 9/10 of our total general fund revenue from personal income tax. The next largest source of revenue dropped from $9 billion down to about between $550 and $600 million, 1/15 of the amount, and that was lottery. And next came corporate income tax in that $400 to $500 million range. So it was an extreme drop, which illustrates our reliance on personal income tax. Which brings me to my next point that if you look at the March forecast, I mean, we don't have a recession. We don't even have first quarter characteristics of a recession. We still have growth. It's just that it's slower than predicted. And that caused $113 million lowering of our projections. So we're not even anywhere close to a recession in the early 80s terms. Furthermore, when that did happen in the early 80s and they had the special sessions, state government was responsible for 30% of K through 12, whereas now state government is responsible for 70%. So the need for stability is more critical, and I think the state budget less flexible. Going along with that, you had lottery, $600 million of lottery roughly, which about $400 million has been dedicated to K through 12, and you'll never spring that loose out of lottery. It's already there, K through 12. So unless there's some new source, it's spent. And then between education endowment, Measure 66, and lottery-backed bonds, the discretionary portion of lottery proceeds is $35, $40 million. It's so small as to almost not make any difference in the state scene. So we're less flexible, more dependent on the fund, and more on a one-legged stool. So I think whether we're talking individual taxpayers, the business community, labor organizations, the key here is not to be complacent. And that's why I appreciate, and I think you're doing the right thing by raising this conversation. And raising it through the BAT, I mean, I think that's a very good, credible proposal that gets this conversation started. And even if people criticize the BAT, I guess the questions of them is, well, how do you improve it? Or what's your idea for an alternative? What do you suggest, and what are you willing to do to make it happen? Because I again think that looking on a wide, all Oregon basis, we have a problem here that we need to intervene on before it becomes a difficult issue. With that, I think status quo is such a comfortable spot to be in, and we've all been there. There have been several runs at changing the tax system, and we've always gotten deflected in the past. It's a huge and difficult issue. I think the BAT is a responsible approach to essentially, I think you're doing some stabilization within that income sphere, but it's still income, but it's more stable. And whether there are additional things that should be considered is also a huge issue. But anyway, I guess I would stop here and encourage you to proceed to push and to raise these questions, because I think it's very important to our state. Thank you for allowing me this time.
Thank you, Tom and John. Questions or comments for either of them on their testimony? Representative Witt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, have either of you given any consideration to how House Bill 3942 might affect business in terms of exports out of state, and if that creates some kind of a competitive disadvantage that we wouldn't want to put Oregon business in?
That's an issue that's always raised with this type of tax, and I think that you would need to look at specific numbers to see exactly how much additional burden, if there is any, there would be on any particular industry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, no, I think that's one of the key questions. I mean, it's not an easy answer. I think I don't think that issue alone is necessarily a killer on this, but I think I think there has to be a lot of work done on it. We also have to look at, you know, what happens to our businesses if we continue on the one-legged stool and we start, you know, eroding essential public safety, education services, and so forth. What that does to our whole community, including our business businesses, in terms of growth and retention of employees and so forth. But clearly, there are other tax principles that continually raise that issue, and I think it has to be carefully reviewed. I don't have the answer for you, though.
Further questions? Representative Bates.
I'll follow up to Representative Witt's question. The VAT tax is deductible against federal taxes. Will that modify the situation significantly, or is that a minor modification as far as the tax that the corporation would be paying or the business would be paying?
I missed a word.
The VAT tax is deductible against federal income taxes. Mm-hmm. And my question is would that modify the concerns we have about the added burden on businesses that are working out, that are selling goods outside the state? I mean, is the federal tax deductibility going to affect the total amount of taxes paid sufficiently to give them some relief, or is it a minor consideration?
Well, I think that the only way to answer that is to look at the numbers, and Paul would have to provide that. You know, during the 80s, we kept hearing about how unfair our corporate income tax system was, and the businesses were moving to Washington where they had a simple little business tax. And so this whole question, I think, is relevant to the type of industry it is and the total tax burden and what the benefits are. As Tom mentioned, if we don't have education that we can provide for our high-tech industries, they're certainly not going to locate here. That's a major issue, I know, with the Oregon manager of Intel, Jim Johnson. You've all read articles in the paper about how he is extremely interested in furthering computer, math, and engineering studies in the state, and that can't come free. So that's probably the main issue for them. It's not a change in the tax system. I think you ought to get him down here to testify on this and ask him what he thinks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, I think the federal deductibility is an offset. Now, whether it's a total offset, it depends on the size of the company and all the other factors, because the VAT would be levied against modified growth, and they might not even have federal income tax in a given year. But it could have a leveling effect, at least, you know, in the country. But it depends, too, on the international. If there's a net increase in the price of the product, then you start running that risk of international sales. So on the other hand, I mean, property tax has certainly been reduced over time, which probably has helped our competitive position. Our income tax, the corporate of 6.6, used to be viewed as higher than average, and now I think it's about average. And if that's reduced, there's an offset there.
you know, all price of doing business. So if their property tax is moderate and their income tax is lowered and their capital gains is provided, the net negative on product distribution costs and so forth may not be significant.
Thank you.
Good questions. Representative Beck.
Mr. Chair, first a comment to staff. Commissioner Bryan's comment raises maybe a way of looking at this. I'm wondering if we could go back in time as we analyze this tax and maybe go back to tax burden in 1989 or 85 and compare that to tax burden today so that we're not always just comparing this tax to what's the current situation, but we look back a little further before Measure 5. I don't know whether we could do that, whether that would be too complicated, mm-hmm. but if there's a way, mm-hmm. it might be kind of interesting so that we're really comparing it to the old tax system, not just what is in place today. My question to you is sort of, both of you, is sort of philosophical. I'm concerned that inertia in this building may get the best of us, and through all the good efforts of the chair, this just doesn't get as far a hearing, let alone some votes on floors, as it certainly merits. There aren't really that many people in the room here, maybe half a dozen business interests that I can see, because I think people figure we don't have the wherewithal in this time and place to move forward with something important like this. What, as people who have been involved with crafting major tax changes, albeit in response to voter-approved initiatives, what would you do to advise us and to prod us to really make as strong an effort as we possibly can, in spite of all the naysaying that we're going to hear in the coming hearings on this?
Well, I'd say, first of all, that you have to satisfy yourselves individually that it's the right thing to do. And you need to ask a lot of questions, and you need to have a lot of data to look at in order to satisfy yourself and be comfortable that you would be doing the right thing. Just to change for the sake of change is not adequate. And then, of course, you have to convince everybody else that it needs to be done, and you need to ever get it passed, probably even through the chambers here, you need a coalition of people who are willing to support this. If you don't have that, it never will pass, even if you pass both houses and refer it out. It still likely would not pass without a strong coalition supporting it. And I think that you have to have certain business groups willing to support it also. There will be some business groups, I'm confident, who will be in here who are interested only in one thing, and that's their own bottom line. And if it's not a benefit to them in terms of dollars and cents, that they'll oppose it. I would also encourage you to think about what might happen if we do have a severe recession. I don't think it'll have to be severe in order to have a severe downturn in revenues. If we have a severe drop in revenues, what then? In the past, at least while I was in the legislature, very often the legislature simply refused to act. And as a result, we have tax law by initiative. And it's not always good. Certainly not as good as could have been crafted in the building. And so I don't need to tell you to be courageous and stand up and do something that you ought not to do. You need to be comfortable, and you need to believe yourself that you're doing the right thing, or you shouldn't support this or anything else. But if you do believe that this is a better way to collect taxes for the sake of the state of Oregon, then I would say go ahead and do it. Talk to your colleagues and try to convince them that this is also a good thing. There will be certain people that are going to vote against any tax measure, and certain people will vote against a tax measure of one type or another. But think of the state of Oregon, what is good for it, and let your conscience be your guide.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Beck, I guess my response is there are a couple of things here. I've been in the writing side of two measures. One was as chair of, in 1993, when I was on the Revenue Committee, I was chair of a subcommittee. We had 12 members on the Revenue Committee, and one of them was the Property Tax Subcommittee. And somehow or another, Chairman Delna Jones assigned me the duty of writing a sales tax initiative. And remember, the tenor of the times was we were facing a $1 billion projected shortfall. And the Speaker, Speaker Campbell at the time, directed the committee to, we had to get something on the ballot. You couldn't go home without getting something on the ballot for the fall. So we looked at all of the options, gross receipts tax and all kinds of things, changing around the income tax. And we came up, you know, with a sales tax. Did a 5% retail sales tax. The rate was locked into the Constitution. We locked constitutionally a spending limit into the Constitution. We locked in the fact that 50% of the revenues went to K through 12 and property tax relief. And we locked in, required a sunset in 6 years. So Oregonians could take a look at it and see how they felt about it 6 years down the line. It was virtually everything I thought we could do to write it as conservatively as possible, as taxpayer friendly as possible. We did build a coalition, had broad support, Associated Oregon Industries and others helped lead the charge, OEA and others were on board. I think $1 million or $1.5 million was spent on the campaign with using all the latest techniques. And I think the results was like similar to the gas tax results. It personally hurt our feelings, but they and everyone was on board. And it just wasn't going to happen. People didn't read past the first sentence of the ballot title. Shall there be a retail sales tax of 5%? And they didn't read any of the other qualifiers or benefits. On the other hand, when 47 came along, I was chair of revenue when the committee wrote Measure 50. Again, a strong coalition was built. I would say 90% of the players, and you know, it was I think that was the first constitutional tax referral by the legislature in Oregon's history. That was constitutionally referred and was, it was legislatively referred, constitutional and involved tax. But I think we had something specific to compare it with, and that's the problem. So I guess I would just say that the coalition is key. I mean, the business, you know, taxes are extremely easy to kill. A tax change will be very easy to kill. So somehow you have to weave the coalition. Now, I agree, this being April 2nd, and we had ours on the ballot in May. It was a different circumstance. Measure 47 was going into effect July 1, so we had to act. You know, I think it's that you still have time to refer out something for an '02, probably an '02 election. If you can put the pieces together and give adequate consideration to all of the issues and build that coalition. Or there's the old fallback, the interim study, but I that's always tough because you know what happens to the interim, a lot of interim studies. But again, the interim study could come back, bring the momentum back into the 03 session, you know, if it comes in with momentum. But again, a lot of the leadership, such as the chair, you know, wouldn't be returning in 03. So you lose some things there, too. But I guess I'm stating the obvious. But I think it's possible to refer something out this session yet. And it's just a matter of how, you know, everyone thinks there ought to be some changes, but everyone has different changes to suggest. And you know, it's the old revenue library trick, Mr. Chairman.
That's right.
Get everybody into the chalkboard. And
may I ask one quick
question? Yes, you sure can.
People always tell us when we go door to door, you got to ask for their vote. Will you support this, and will you go out to some of the businesses in Washington County and ask for their support?
Yes, I would support this, and I think, you know, again, I'm not an expert. I would say I am supportive, A, that we do something, B, that this is a viable issue to go with and support, but also be listening to ways to improve it. And
these issues such as export issues and problems. We've got to factor those in because, you know, the business is the golden goose that's, you know, providing the revenue that helps with the education and everything. So, but the balance point, I mean, I've found in my experience business to be very responsible and step up, and we just have to get a clearer handle and make sure we're not, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There may be phased-in approaches, which get more complicated, but allow people to, you know, to analyze the change. It perhaps could be done in stages. But I would be very happy to participate in any way that the committee would ask me to do.
I'll do that.
Other questions, Representative Witt?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're not contemplating a referral. No. This is strictly statutory.
The way it's drafted, this is a statutory, that's right, statutory enactment. Okay. Yeah.
I thought I heard Representative Beck wanted to lead a campaign out there with the voters.
Well, that would be the inevitable campaign on the referendum, probably.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I think I probably tainted it that way, Representative Witt. Statutorily, you know, obviously it works. Most of our implementing language is statutory and would work. And as long as the coalition's there, then you're less likely to have a successful, you know, initiative referral.
So let me ask, and John, I guess both of you too, you mentioned the, the interim study and the history we have with interim studies of changes in the tax system and the record of those, I guess, in terms of where we are today. Granted, something as momentous as what is proposed in House Bill 3942 merits as much study as anyone can give it. By the same token, I'm concerned that we can study these things just long enough to make sure nothing happens to them.
Right.
But the other question I would ask is, my sense from everything that we hear in this committee and what we read about in the popular news and economic news is that we are just about at the crest here of a long period of growth, in fact, an unprecedented period of growth, and it seems to be that President Bush has to be a booster, and he can't talk about these things, but we're just here in the troughs, the trenches, so I think we can. We're concerned about the prospect of being at the crest and looking down at a pretty deep trough ahead of us, and depending on what some economists tell us, not just a short-term trough, but it could be a longer-term period of declining growth or recessionary influences. And I guess that raises the question in my mind as to timing. Let's take a scenario where we are indeed at the crest of the wave now, and in 2 years we're down. And again, I think what we've seen in the last couple of months, it doesn't take a recession to have a pretty dramatic influence on the effect of state revenues and then our ability to fund programs. What's your sense of how much easier or more difficult it would be to look at something fundamental in the way of restructuring if we're in that downtime, as opposed to where we are today, which is still up and not quite over the crest? And I've likened it to trying to, if we wait, I've likened it to trying to fix the leak in the boat out in the middle of the storm. Tough to do.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're right. I mean, I think it's always more difficult under pressure, and when there's drop-offs in revenue, then the thinking will be, well, it's what would create new revenue. Now you're starting to replace revenue.
Right.
Versus if you do it now where it's still relatively level, you can be talking about how do we keep what we have. I mean, I know there are a lot of folks who would like new revenue, but facing the alternative of a decline, keeping what we have probably is going to look very attractive and be a good policy for the state. And it might be a number that you could build a coalition around. And as soon as there's new revenue, of course, you start losing a lot of folks. And so I think this is a good time. And one other thing I'd mention is I remember in 97 there were several pieces of the tax system outside of 47 that were proposed and even rolled out to the floor, some of which actually passed and then were vetoed. But my point is that I heard a lot about, well, this is piecemealing our tax system. I want to do it all comprehensively. And it was within 12 months of the session signing that some of the folks who were saying that were proposing various other, you know, piecemeal approaches. And my point is, you know, doing something in the big magic stroke is very, very difficult. So doing what you can, I mean, our tax system changes incrementally, both to the good and to the bad, and that's where we are today, is incremental changes. And I think that you're going to do a fully comprehensive fix-all is not realistic for anyone to ask you to do or expect you to do. But I would target on, you know, are there one or two pieces we can do now, this session, that brings some stability? May not be the overall, but anything you can save, you know, $100 or $200 or $300 million, keeping existing revenue in a way that's still fair, is a big gain. I guess I would say look for logical pieces and not just the big fix.
Well, I would say, first of all, that there's no rainy day fund. And if we have a serious downturn in revenues, it's going to require either severe cuts or raising taxes. And then, of course, the question is, who pays them? Who's going to pay the taxes? Now, how severe any recession or downturn is going to be, we don't really know, and Paul's the only person that can predict that. But we could have looked, and we did, some of us, a year or a year and a half ago, when oil prices went up and rates went up at the same time. We are just now seeing the true effect of that. It actually started things moving in the wrong direction at that time. It's taken a full year for the layoffs to happen. Okay, now we're having large numbers of people laid off. Paul, I think, will tell you that there's still an increase in employment, but not nearly as high. Well, if those layoffs get into a negative situation, then it'll be another year before that lack of purchasing power affects the economy. And so there is really the potential, I think, from this to have a real roller coaster ride. And personally, I think the greatest danger is overreacting to it, not here, but in Washington, creating inflation, which was the real bugaboo back in the late 70s, and that's the thing that created the 81 recession, trying to get out of it, trying to get away from the inflation, terrible inflation that we had. That, I might say, is also what I think initiated Measure 5, and it wasn't just the property taxes, but it was the inflation that was taking a bigger percentage of people's income through the income tax system also. So anyway, I think that there's a huge potential for things going wrong, and I would urge you to proceed now. If it doesn't sell now, sometimes things have to cook a little longer. And perhaps then next time. But I would encourage you to think very strongly about what could go wrong, and what is likely to go wrong, maybe is a better way to say that, in the sense of downturn revenues, and do what you think needs to be done. Don't wait. And I guess I would differ from Tom in that I would try to go for the whole program now, rather than trying to do it piecemeal. It's true. What Tom said is very true. We have incrementally changed our tax system. It's been very seldom, very rare, that we've made a major change. I think the income tax system was implemented in World War I, and that's been the last big change. But I would encourage you to do this now, and if it doesn't sell, maybe it'll keep cooking.
Any other questions for these wise men of former revenue committee?
Sure.
Yes.
They maybe do a.
An assessment here.
Hang on, John. He's reaching for the
testimony. We're going to see what.
No reaction.
Ah, there we go.
I was expecting. They started chanting the shoot.
All right. I want to thank you both very much for the benefit of your experience and comments today. All right. Who said we can't have fun?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hass.
I sincerely hope that 2 years from now, you're not sitting down there telling us that, you know, we should get to work.
No, my testimony will be short and to the point. I told you. No, no, no. This is not a reflection on your testimony. Okay, we have some, I'm sorry, yes.
If I could add something in kind of the response to some of the questions on the base and on the export base, we don't have a full a breakdown of industry for the entire BAT base, but we do for the C corporations, which make up about 75% of the base. And the packet that you had on Friday, on the very last page of that packet, does show you the industry breakdown. In terms of C corps.
Just a second, Paul, before you. Oh, let's take a second here and get these out. This is the. This one?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Last page?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That would give you at a very high level of aggregation, but it gives you the what we call the one digit level, the breakout of how the BAT base would be distributed. And notice that the manufacturing sector is about 18.6% of that base. And that's really where your key exporters are. You can anticipate that, you know, that a very large proportion of those manufacturers are either exporters or in direct competition with out-of-state companies exporting into the state. So that's 18.6%. You also notice there's a not reported businesses, corporations have not reported their income. So you could assume that that would be another proportion of manufacturers.
Not reported their income or not reported their classification?
Didn't report the classification. Yeah. Their income, you can see, right, is about $3.1 billion, or about 10% of the total. So you would add another 2%, say, to that number, so about 21% on the manufacturing side would give you a rough idea of what the manufacturing base would be. Exporters as a whole would probably be around 25% of the total. Again, I would emphasize the policy choices here for you. There's really two of them that directly affect the multi-state companies, and that is the apportionment formula that would go with this. Currently, the bill has the apportionment formula that's in current law of the double-weighted sales, and under the House Bill 3942, the apportionment formula would become even more important, because not only would you allocate the entire BAT base, but the capital expenditures are also apportioned in the bill. So, again, on a double-weighted basis. So that gives you a policy lever to work with. Any changes there in terms of the sales factor in particular has an important implications for the manufacturing sector and, therefore, exporters.
Well, I just want to make a note. You've got these are the C corps on this exhibit, and you said that these represent what percentage of the total of the BAT base?
The total BAT base in 1998 is $42 billion, so it's about 31 of the 42, or about three quarters.
So who are the other 10 or 11, 12?
The other 75%, 25%, are S corps, partnerships.
Okay.
LLCs.
So those tend to be there are some large S corporations that are export-based manufacturers, but certainly in terms of proprietorships and partnerships, they tend to be disproportionately more what we call domestic sector. They're selling into the Oregon market rather than exporting out.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
This does not include the businesses who would be exempt from the BAT. The small,
right.
That's on the page right. Before. Well,
this is just the total base before any exemptions or any threshold.
Okay.
Got a couple. Yes, Representative Carlson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand this, and so this is a dumb question. Forgive me. Mm-hmm. But are these okay? Positive net business income. So these are paying right now a corporate income tax, correct? Is there any way we can see the comparison between what they are, you know, what the sectors are paying and what they would pay, so we can kind of get a sense of who wins and who loses under
the last page.
Current system and the proposed system? I mean, how does this relate to that? This chart that you have here, what can we learn from that?
One.
very first line of income.
The chart is showing you what the tax base is, and so, you know, what you're doing in terms of, we can look at the corporate income base, and we could look at what that base is, and essentially you're looking at a 2.5% rate on business activities versus a 6.6% rate for the corporate base. In most all cases, corporations would pay more because it's a much broader base that we're looking at under the BAT than we would be under the current corporate base. And if you look at the underlying numbers in terms of that static revenue impact, essentially what you're doing is when it's fully phased in is raising about $2.5 billion in BAT, and you're reducing corporate by about $1.2 billion. So that's the difference there in terms of that base.
Anything else? I have a couple of witnesses signed up to testify today. I will bring them up first. Bob Castagna. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Castagna, director of the Oregon Catholic Conference, which is the public policy office of the Archdiocese of Portland and the Diocese of Baker. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon on House Bill 3942. While the conference does not have a position on the bill as a whole, I would like to indicate some conference concerns and share some perspectives with you. As I have previously testified before this committee, the departure point for economic decisions, as the Catholic bishops and the Catholic bishops of Oregon begin their analysis of economic decision making, we start with three questions. What does this decision do to the poor? What does the decision do for the poor? And how do the poor participate in it? So that becomes our departure point in terms of our analysis. So while we are not going to most likely take a position with respect to the distribution between personal income and business income in terms of that mix, that becomes a decision maker for the policy makers, although personally I agree there's been a significant shift over the last 12, 13 years or so in terms of the percentage that personal income taxpayers are paying. But I did want to focus on the potential impact of this legislation on the poor, since that's our primary concern. And I've handed you two documents, which I'd like to use and ask you to reference as we go through this. One is the distribution from your staff's office of ballot measure number 88 and how measure 88 impacted various categories of incomes in the state of Oregon and how the distribution of that benefit will flow to the taxpayers subsequent to its passage last November. And the second document is on Oregon Catholic Conference stationery entitled Campaign for Fairness, and the two documents are related. First, let's look at Measure 88, since that is what sequentially happened first. Measure 88 passed last November. And from just looking at the math in terms of the percentage of tax reduction, as we look in the all returns category and those returns 50,000 and above, and then we look at the column just to the right of center in the page, percentage of tax reduction, a quick addition of the math shows that slightly more than 80% of the benefits of Measure 88 flow to the top 31% of returns above 50,000 in the state of Oregon. If we look more closely at those all returns figures, if we notice those 30,000 and below, they get little if any benefit from Measure 88. The average change per taxpayer in the $20,000 to $30,000 category is $3, and below that
there's no average change percent of tax reduction. But when we look at the number of filers, those filers add up significantly to a significant percentage, if not a majority, of the taxpayers in the state of Oregon. And yet even under 40,000, they get like 7.4% of the tax reduction benefit. And yet when we look at the cost, this biennium, the LRO estimated cost is $159 million for 2001-2003. An effort is being put together and has been launched by faith-based and community organizations called the Campaign for Fairness. And what we are trying to do is to maintain the safety net of state programs for vulnerable people, as well as try to lift people out of poverty. So that you see before you in the Campaign for Fairness documents a proposal equal to $158.65 million. Program restorations in the Adult and Family Services Division budget, a food stamp outreach program, case reserve for TANF cash grants, substantial program restorations in the Senior and Disabled Services Division budget, an affordable housing component, and then the last item, D, refundable earned income credit, $16 million estimated impact, and a refundable working family child care credit, also $16 million. So that when we look at 3942, we are delighted to see that refundable EITC has been included as part of the language of the printed version of 3942. I know as part of the report that you've handed out, it is the expressed possibility, another possibility not currently in the bill, is adding the refundable feature to the current working family credit. And in your OTM results, static revenue impact estimate, you have established refundable EIC at 15% federal. As I recall the testimony from the hearings that were held on the refundable EITC and refundable working family child care credit from the advocates for this legislation, the preference was the refundable working family child care credit in first preference, followed by the refundable earned income tax credit. So I'm delighted to see, number one, that in your analysis of the impacts of 3942 and its distribution effects, that those below $14,525 would have this 3.6% change as percent of baseline net household income. We would hope that if the refundable working family child care credit were attached and made a part of this legislation, that would increase that income flow to that category. And we would encourage you in those pursuits and also encourage you to make the earned income tax credit refundable and to look to stretching it up to the 15% refundable. If we're looking at restructuring the revenues of the state, again, I come back to those first three questions. What does it do to the poor? What does it do for the poor? And how do the poor participate in it? Now, when you look at the Oregon Campaign for Fairness document, you will see on the second document, Campaign for Fairness, who the sponsors are of the Campaign for Fairness. And that list has been expanded today to include the Episcopal Diocese of Eastern Oregon, the AME Church, Albina Ministerial Alliance, the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. This coalition, this co-sponsors of the Campaign for Fairness, is growing in its breadth across the state of Oregon. And we will be engaging in a significant grassroots effort and outreach across this state to bring the needs of Oregon's vulnerable population to a position of visibility and, we hope and pray, prioritization through the rest of this legislative process. We are morally compelled to do that because many of these vulnerable people, primarily poor women and children, cannot speak for themselves. And we will act in solidarity with them to try to convince this legislature to prioritize their interests as this legislature goes about its duty of balancing the budget and trying to determine the next course for revenue policy in the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions? I want to have all the OTIM results, the distribution effects that show the 3.6 and the other numbers there on those income groups. Do those include the 15% working family child care tax credit refundable, or do you recall what the components were to get to that?
Mr. Chair, they do include the package as we've outlined it on the static revenue impact measure that Bob referred to. And that's, so the EIC is there. We do not have a refundable working family credit built into this estimate.
Can we assume, I guess maybe we shouldn't assume, but let me ask if we had the working family child care tax credit as opposed to the refundable EIC, do you think the numbers would likely look similar?
I think the numbers for the income groups would look similar. But remember, you'd be targeting a different groups of people within that. We don't have our chart, Bruce's chart on the,
no, I'm missing
the components of those income groups. But, it would be a different set of households, but they would be predominantly within that same income group.
Representative Bates.
Just a quick question. You know, I sit on Ways and Means, and all the other members of this committee, and the question always is, if I give you this, where does it come from? As your coalition talked about other sources of revenue, increasing the cigarette tax, beer and wine tax, rescinding 88,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bates, we have discussed sources of revenue, and we are urging this legislature to increase state revenues to fund the campaign for fairness. Increase state revenues. There are a number of sources. Kicker funds is one of them, and we are saying including the use of kicker funds. We believe those are legitimate and available revenues to the people of the state of Oregon and this legislature to address the significant unmet human needs of the people of this state. From a moral perspective, if we had to put in the scales of justice and before the eyes of God, the difference between sending a $150 or $200 check and preserving poor moms and kids so that they don't have to be homeless and that we don't have an increase in juvenile delinquency and that seniors don't have to be put out of their homes, the scales of justice, and from a moral perspective, we say that has a greater claim on the resources than sending back a $100 or $250 kicker check. And we would urge you to use that moral judgment to place priorities in their proper order. One final comment on the legislation itself. On page 4, with respect to...
What about the bill?
3942, we would ask that the refundable nature of these credits be made on a continuous appropriation basis so that the credits do not have to be reduced. Other states have refundable credits. We would like to see it to be a continuous appropriation rather than it be subject to the limits of the appropriation and have to be reduced so that people receive the full benefit of a refundable credit.
Anything else? Bob, I think it's unlikely that you're going to see an increase in revenue out of this session. I guess I would at least remark to you that under 3942, we can get pieces of this, and a significant piece, the refundable working family child care tax credit, on a revenue neutral basis.
Well, whatever way you can go to get there, we would support. Again, I guess I come back to our baseline. We're not so much interested in taking revenues from other programs as we are in justice, increasing the revenues to meet the needs of this vulnerable population.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gary Carlson. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Gary Carlson with Associated Oregon Industries. As you know, AOI represents 20,000 businesses across the state of Oregon, and I'm not sure all of you completely understand the makeup of our membership, but it is a very broad membership. We're not a trade association. So we have members approximately proportional to the population of the state in various parts of the state. We have small mom-and-pop businesses, if you will. We have giant manufacturers as well as financial institutions, insurance companies, and everything in between that you can think of. So we do look at issues like taxation in a very broad sense. That is, how do they affect the economy? How do they affect business generally and the ability of people to start and operate a business successfully in the state of Oregon? I want to start out, Mr. Chair, particularly acknowledging and thanking you for your work on trying to think through some other alternatives to the tax system that we have. I'd like to see Batman up there waving his arms because
with that statement, we will bring him up for a quick response.
Yeah. Hey, thank you. That may be the only waving of his arms that I get.
Be ready, the next one might fly off the base. The bat base.
But in all sincerity, I do think that your work has been extensive and is acknowledged certainly by us and others who have observed it. I'm here on behalf of our members, unfortunately, from particularly, I think, the chair's perspective, to oppose this bill today. While we over the years have been in support of major tax restructure that would create a system that's more typical of the 50 state tax structures, achieving that has been very, very difficult and elusive, as you know. The sales tax, the old so-called third leg of the stool, the consumption leg, has been the one that that various legislatures have attempted to add to our revenue mix while reducing our high reliance on property and income taxes 9 times. And as you know, the voters have defeated those measures on the ballot every time, the most recent by a 3-to-1 margin in 1993. And the reasons stated typically in polling information and anecdotal, I think, is that people in Oregon just flat out dislike the sales tax. And also there's certainly a strong element of a lack of trust of their government to hold its spending in check. And I think the anecdotal responses that we've gotten over the years are, yeah, it'll start out at 3%, and then it'll go to 4%, and then it'll go to 5% and 6%, and on and on. This measure, 3942, would implement really what amounts to hidden sales tax. I don't think anyone would disagree with that the goal is to have it passed through in prices. Business would pay it initially, and then the goal would be to have it passed through as prices, because I don't think it's your attempt, anyone on this committee, to damage the economy and the ability of business to be successful and to pass on this cost to their customers. But we think this measure could easily have some damaging impacts on Oregon's economy. Now, from a philosophical point of view, we don't believe the taxes should be hidden from the consumer. Federal, state, and local taxes now consume over 40% of all personal income in this country. The national debate on taxes has indicated that federal taxes are now higher than they were at their highest in the history of this country, and that was during World War II. So we have historically for this country a very high rate of tax load right now, and of course it doesn't look high relative to some of the socialist cradle to grave socialism countries, perhaps in Europe, where the tax rate is upwards of 2/3 of all income generated is captured by government and redistributed in social welfare and other programs. But still, for the United States, we are at historic high level of tax burden. Clearly, this measure would be, I think, a hidden sales tax for Oregon consumers. And since there's no way to exempt certain basic necessities, as we usually talk about in a sales tax, of food, medicine, clothing, the impacts, initial impacts, would be highly regressive to the extent that the business owner is successful in passing along this tax increased load. One of the stated goals of this proposal is to stabilize Oregon's revenue system. From the perspective of businesses that would have to pay this major new tax, the stability of government would come at the expense of conversion from a profits-based tax to an ongoing operating expense regardless of income. That's the value-added or the business activities tax. I served on the governor's committee about 3 years ago as we were approaching the 99 session. I think this was winter of 98. I was one of several people from various interest groups on that governor's technical committee. And I argued very, very vigorously that this issue of stability is certainly in the eye of the beholder, whether it's good or bad, as Dr. Bates said earlier with regard to another issue. It depends on where you stand. And the point that I tried to make in that group was that stability for government does come at the expense of the citizenry who supports with their taxes those services. And it's not all bad to, when recessionary times come for government, to also look very hard at its expenditures and find places where it can economize and reduce expenses. I think one of the things that is most baffling to businesses is this concept of the CSL, which you are all very familiar with, even those of you who are freshmen, the Continuing Service Level Budget, which is the roll-up costs of what we did last biennium, rolled up for inflation and population changes, and that's what we have to have in order to have a government and government services that fill the needs of the citizenry. Businesses find that very confusing. Many of you I know are in business, and I know that you look at your expenses very hard every year, squeezing out every efficiency you can possibly find in order to stay competitive and turn a profit. That is what businesses see as lacking in the way government looks at its budgeting process and its fiscal needs. Enough said, I don't want to sound like I'm lecturing, but I just want to relay that. For those business entities not organized as C corporations, this proposal represents simply an added, what they perceive to be a heavy new tax burden. The exemption of a broad base of smaller businesses would appear to follow the old axiom of taxation, and that is what you need to try to do is extract the maximum amount of down from the goose with the least amount of hissing. And I think to a certain extent, this proposal succeeds at that with its $100,000, really $125,000 zero tax liability. But it does also depend on how the business is organized, as I think you've heard and you've acknowledged, and that I've mentioned, whether you pay the corporate income tax of 6.6% because you're organized as a C corporation, federal Section C corporation, or not, sole proprietor, LLC, S corporation. In the short amount of time we've had to review this proposal, I'd like to share some of the concerns that have been expressed by our members. The C-Corps are not certain how this would affect them until they do, particularly probably the larger corporations, a great deal of analytical work. Typically what they would do is go to their tax departments and say, here's a bill, here's a proposal, crunch the numbers. How does it affect us? How does it affect us in a good year? How does it affect us in a bad year? Tell us everything you can think of about how this would affect us relative to how the current system affects us. For those involved in international trade, and I think this has been talked about briefly so far in your discussions, and Oregon is a heavy exporting state, this measure could be counterproductive in that it would make Oregon products less competitive in international markets. Many of these industries that form the backbone of Oregon's economy, timber, agriculture, and silicon chip manufacturers now being a large segment of our manufacturers, they're really price takers in an international market. They're not price setters. They can't simply say we've got another effective 1.75 or 2% tax on gross, and we'll just pass it through in prices. They have many, many, many competitors within this country and outside the borders of this country, and they're selling into an international market. So if their tax burden increases, it's not as simple as grossing up the price and passing it along. Oregon is now 28% dependent on manufacturing, and much of this production is sold in the international markets. Sole proprietors, sub-S, and limited liability corporations, the ones that we have talked to in the relatively short amount of time since we've had an opportunity to become aware of this measure, see only increased taxes and only relatively modest reductions in personal income taxes. These businesses see this proposal as, let's say, roughly a 20% increase in their tax burden. And the objective, I know and you know, is to have them to simply raise their prices and to pass the increased tax burden along to their consumers. But business people don't like to raise their prices. And they particularly don't like to raise their prices when the purpose is not to maybe get a little better edge on profitability, a little more profit to put in their pocket, but the purpose is really to pay a new tax load, as this measure would put into place. Smaller businesses, exempt due to the dollar volume limitation, many of them want to grow in the future, but see only a substantial new tax load when they cross the exemption threshold, and it really becomes somewhat of an impediment, psychological or otherwise, to growth, to become larger. And I think we want to see our small businesses grow and prosper and become larger. As we lose more and more corporate headquarters, I think that becomes more and more important. I know we in the association world look to our up-and-comer, rising star businesses who are growing and flourishing to help replace some of the dynamism that we get from corporate headquarters that are leaving the state. While HB 3942 does not address the spending limitation, it has been mentioned as a part of a larger package of proposals as this measure is designed to take shape. And given the magnitude, complexity, and potential but unknown impacts on the Oregon economy of this bill, our suggestion would be that this legislature proceed to design a constitutional spending limitation on state government for referral to voters next year. And I noted with interest in the Oregonian, I think it was just yesterday, that the House co-chair of Ways and Means was quoted as talking about the need to follow up with the defeat of the spending limitation that was on the ballot last November with a legislative and crafted measure which would hopefully take care of some of the problems that we're seeing, such as including federal funds that was included in the measure that was defeated. A spending limitation, once adopted by voters and put in place, will establish a framework for discussion, I think, of tax restructure ideas such as this bill with the Oregon electorate. We would therefore urge you not to proceed this legislative session with HB 3942. Its potential impacts, we feel, are too great and time is too short to fully evaluate and address potential impacts of the measure and to achieve voter understanding of the measure and its impacts. And I think given the history of major tax restructure proposals in this state, that it would be imperative to do that given the propensity of the citizenry to ask to be involved in final decisions of tax changes of the magnitude contemplated in this measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't feel bad if I don't get another Batman arm flap.
I will save you.
I want to thank you for your time. Glad to answer your question.
Representative, let me say this. We are we're to the end of our hour, and I know we've gotten a memo from the leadership asking us not to be going over our time. I'll let Representative Witt ask the question because he had his hand up before I said that. Gary, this is back up on Wednesday. Are you able to come back on Wednesday?
Yes, certainly.
Let's continue this conversation. Okay. I appreciate it. From the beginning, you've been up front in terms of, number one, wanting to evaluate it, and then number two, you have issues on the evaluation, and I think you've raised legitimate concerns that we need to be very much aware of. even if we disagree on some of the impacts, whether they be short-term or long-term, but the conversation I want to continue, I think it's very worthwhile. If you'll come back on Wednesday. But Representative Witt, let's...
Mr. Chairman, I either have one long question or two short.
Okay, you may have them both, right. Either way.
Okay, Gary, you make the point that AOI likes to have explicit as opposed to hidden taxes. I think that's a good position. But isn't the corporate income tax also hidden to consumers in the same way that this business activities tax would be hidden to consumers? And if so, we're really not changing the effect of policy in terms of a hidden tax, are we?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wynn, I think that's true, although the economists, I think, will tell you that the corporate profits tax is generally split up in terms of its impact. Consumers do not bear generally the full brunt of the corporate profits tax. Business owners typically experience the lion's share of the impact.
And wouldn't this likely be the same? I mean, because a business person, a business owner, to the extent that he or she can, is going to pass their costs on. There's competitive restraints that keep you from doing that. And that would be true of a corporate income tax or a business activity tax, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think that's true.
As your former lawyer just interjecting here, too, because I do recall the testimony from Tony Ruffalo was that you can design this value-added kind of tax to mimic things from production orientation to consumption orientation. As I recall, his explanation of this was not so much that it had elements of consumption in it, but it was also a production-oriented kind of value-added. So he didn't, origin-based, I'm sorry, yeah, he didn't regard it as mimicking necessarily a sales tax. So that's the same kind of...
Yeah, I'm actually comparing it with a corporate income
tax.
Right,
right.
And the other point on that, Representative Wood, I think, is that the magnitude, the order of magnitude of the impact here of 1.1, 1.2 billion versus 2.3, 2.4 billion is, I think, makes that that issue a larger one.
I think that's true. If I can real quickly one last question.
Sure.
And that's the question. I mean, generally, I've always believed you shouldn't be taxing a business or an individual unless there's income there to tax. This taxes activities as opposed to income. How about the argument that businesses that, even if they don't show a profit, they're still benefiting from government services and thus should pay a tax? Does that argument have any validity in your opinion?
Certainly, I think it has validity, Representative Witt. We all, as citizens of the state, get benefits. We get benefits as individuals and as businesses. In terms of a variety of things, transportation is the first one that comes to mind. The ability to get raw materials if you're a manufacturer in the door, and move out your finished product, for example, to get customers into your door, if you're a retailer, and safely in and out of your business establishment. So certainly there are benefits, and there are economists and gurus I think that could go on at length about various ways of looking at who benefits from government services and what a fair enough fair share of the tax burden they should pay.
Okay. Oh, you wanted to touch on one thing, I think, and then we'll finish up.
I just wanted to add, Mr. Chair, that as we've kind of still deciphering all what OTIM has told us from last Friday, and one of the things I wanted to point out is that there are two ways to shift the tax burden on business. One is what we call forward shifting, which is what we've talked about in terms of consumer prices. Now, the other way is backward shifting, which would be onto labor, onto wages, which is really one of the things that OTIM is telling us. You look at the results of the OTIM analysis, wages are lower by 1.2%. So what that's telling us is that businesses are offering lower wages, partly people accept that because they have a higher net income after tax. So there is some shifting going back.
Because of the personal side.
Because they have lower tax burden on personal income taxes. So that what happens is you end up with a lower gross wage, and that's where some of that shifting is going on, onto labor.
So in other words, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
The chairman's bill is going to cause wages to go down, is what you're saying.
But net household income to go up.
Okay. Net income.
It's Representative Wynn. Representative Payne.
Well, Representative Witt got his finger up before I did, but I've got questions. Are we going to follow up with more questions?
Yes, we are. Gary, you can come back on Wednesday. I appreciate this. This is high level and very useful.
We'll have tomorrow.
Thank you. We are adjourned.